work that I had poured my heart into for years of my life. It's ready. We can move on to the next steps now. I hadn't realized I'd been holding my breath until a burst of air exploded from my lungs. Really? Seriously? It needs revision, but this is a good draft. No rewrite? No rewrite. My plan was to say gracious words in response, maybe even including a witty twist. In fact, I had been rehearsing my confident and professional comments, muttering them animatedly into the mirror as I brushed my teeth or blew dry my hair. But now, none of the words would come. And when I tried to speak, I broke into an enormous sob that had been trying to escape for a long time. Chapter 28. Life Party. That night, after everyone else was in bed, I cleared off my desk to make a clean space for the revision process. When I leaned over my chair to toss a handful of junk into a catch-all basket on a shelf behind me, I noticed a large stack of paper at the bottom. It was my first draft, the manuscript Ted rejected. I fished it out from under a mess of extension cords and packing tape and pulled this first version of my book onto my lap. It had been so long since I'd laid eyes on this. In fact, I thought I'd thrown it away. I flipped through it, shaking my head wistfully at all the memories and emotion contained in these papers. The faded beige splatters across one page reminded me of the time a rowdy game of hide-and-seek collided with my plan to review the work as I sipped coffee. I saw a paragraph and could almost hear the old 97 song that blasted in my headphones as I wrote it. What was most striking, though, is how clearly I saw my mistakes now. What was I thinking? I whispered as I noticed one error after another. The difference in quality between this draft and the one I'd just finished was extreme to the point that they seemed to have been written by different people. For all of these years, I assumed that my work would be worse for the fact that I was trying to balance it with family life. Back when I used to fantasize about my long, quiet days in a house out of the Pottery Barn catalog, I assumed that then is when my practice of the craft would really shine. I would be able to follow the rules of the creativity experts and have a regular and uninterrupted work schedule. Then, finally, I would live up to my full potential as a writer. But as I flipped through the pages of this old draft, a new paradigm took shape in my mind. One in which all of the interruptions due to my family responsibilities might have actually made me better at what I do. I almost always felt pressure to get as much done as I could before someone woke up from a nap or had a meltdown, and this made me less prone to fits of procrastination. Back when I worked on the humor essay website when Joe and I were dating, I was able to schedule writing sessions that could go on for hours. Without hard time limits, I churned out longer, more self-indulgent passages than when I was writing within the pressures of family life. Igor Stravinsky said that the more constraints one imposes, the more one frees oneself. I'd come across the quote years before, but I only now got it. When water is confined in a narrow space like a tube or a ravine, it will rush forward with power. When it has infinite room to expand, it becomes a puddle. The same thing happens with our creative juices. If I had had perfect control over my schedule, I would have been a productivity machine. I would have churned out one page after another, nailing deadlines and slam dunking all of my goals. There would be no pauses in that perfect world where my life was the craft. And what these past few years had shown me is that there is great power in pauses, whether they're chosen by you or foisted upon you. The weeks when I had new babies were times for me to shift gears and forget all about my work. I would immerse myself fully in the intense moments of nurturing vulnerable new life. Then, when I returned to my writing weeks later, I would come back with a fresh, new perspective. I would discover errors that had been invisible to me before. I'd find that many of my old ideas were now richer and fuller after being given some time to grow. I also used all the little pauses that came up during times of illness or busyness as an opportunity to educate myself. I'd carry around books about sentence structure and story craft, sneaking peeks throughout the day and in the evening before I went to sleep. All of this eventually added up to a substantial body of knowledge, and I now felt like a warrior who'd finally been trained to use her sword. There is a tendency with anyone who loves any kind of work to fantasize that if you just had endless time for it, you'd be able to achieve perfection in this field. Yet what I discovered is that when you put love first, not only does your life improve, but your work improves. The painter makes time to visit an ailing friend and sees a glow in her face that inspires a whole new series of pieces. The songwriter pauses her career to adopt a child and comes back so raw from her experience that she churns out one passionate tune after another. In my case, I faced interruption after interruption in my house full of babies. And in the process, I finally learned how to write a book. I thought back to the joy-filled priest, Father George, who changed our lives with the advice he gave me at the extrovert retreat. He told me to see my work as only one small part of a greater vision, which means accepting those interruptions and times when I need to step away. I knew even at the time that this would lead to a better life. What I didn't know is that it would make me better at my craft, too. I was glad I had that realization about the power of pauses, since I had plenty of time to put it into practice in the following months. The final edits Ted needed me to make were taking longer than I thought they would, and he couldn't start pitching the book to publishers until they were done. Meanwhile, our home life had been utterly derailed when Netflix suddenly removed Pammy's favorite show, Shaun the Sheep, from its lineup. The role Shaun played in our house was similar to the role a snake charmer might play in a cobra-infested village. I tried to get her interested in Timmy Time, a Shaun spinoff that featured a similarly animated character. When she toddled over to the TV and punched Timmy's face on the screen, life as I knew it was over. My only solace was in the comments I received when I wrote about this turn of events on my blog, such as, "Amen. We discovered Dora was gone at 4:46 a.m. one morning. The very fact that I was searching for Dora at 4:46 a.m. says it all." And, "We have been there with the Wiggles. And also, if you do a search for it, they no longer have any of their shows, but it will bring up several adult films under the Bikini Babes series. You might be tempted to read the description to find out why this show popped up when you were searching for the Wiggles. Just don't." As I settled into my new existence of having Pammy repeatedly hit me as she screamed, "Shaun Sheep!" I had a thought that probably could have gotten me diagnosed as being clinically insane. This would be a great time to have a sixth baby. We didn't have a car that would fit six kids. We still couldn't quite afford a bigger house. Money was as tight as ever. Pammy was as crazy as ever. And yet, Joe and I felt strongly open, even excited, about adding another child to the family. Part of it was that we were optimistic about money. My writing career was finally starting to get traction. Right after Ted said the book was almost ready, an editor from a respected magazine said he wanted to talk with me about doing a regular column with them. It would be a bigger commitment than doing the blogging work I'd been doing at the Register, but it would be a much better income, too. Ted was confident that we could find a publisher for the book, and that might help pay a few bills as well. But the biggest reason behind my piece was simply that I'd come to understand that things don't have to be perfect in order to welcome new people. I'd come to think of life like a party. If more folks show up, it's more fun. It might mean you run out of the fancy hors d'oeuvres and everyone ends up snacking on chips and salsa. Things might get too loud, drinks might get spilled, and the guests might even annoy you sometimes. But nobody ever wished there were fewer people at their event. There might be times in life when the responsible choice is not to let others in. It's not a good idea to host a barbecue if you're, say, currently battling a rattlesnake infestation. But those times aren't as frequent as we think. I also felt stronger than I had in years, both mentally and physically. In the time since I'd started thinking from a family perspective instead of a purely individualistic perspective, an ironic thing happened. I started taking better care of myself. Back when I had the mentality that my life is fundamentally about me, I saw the self-giving and service that comes with babies and young children as a fleeting season of life. Just grit your teeth and get through this time of sacrifice, I'd tell myself. Soon it will be over, and you'll be back to your real life. These past few crazy intense years had shattered that perspective. Each of the millions of little moments of love had chipped away at my old way of thinking. Sipping tea served in china cups with the neighbor girls, seeing the light in Papa's eyes every time we visited, watching the kids explode with excitement every time a grandparent walked in the front door, congratulating our babysitter, Monica, when she announced that, thanks to this job, she'd finally saved enough to get her own car, and, of course, the endless hugs from short, chubby arms. Like a stream slowly smoothing over rough stones, these moments had eroded my old way of thinking. I no longer thought that my real life was waiting for me out there in the future when I'd have perfect freedom and control over my days. And so I had started to take care of my own needs without guilt. I'd recently read a book about Mother Teresa, and I noticed something fascinating. The daily schedule she set for her order, the Missionaries of Charity, included a lot of breaks. I was shocked to see that these nuns had dedicated time to tend to their personal needs. Mother Teresa described how she and her sisters took time for church and prayer every morning without fail. Then they went out to leper colonies, slums, or the home for the dying and the destitute, working for 4.5 hours. After that, they would come back for lunch at around 12:30 p.m. Lunch was followed by half an hour of rest because they had been on their feet so long. Later in the afternoon, there was reading and tea, prayer and community camaraderie, followed by another 3 hours of working with the poor before they ended the day with dinner and prayers. The needs of the people they served were endless. In theory, the nuns could help more people if they skipped the time for prayer and tea and reading. In fact, if Mother Teresa had run her order the way I'd run my house, she'd have cut out all leisure activities in addition to breakfast and lunch. She'd tell herself that there was no space for relaxation or real meals because there was so much to do. Was it because she and the other sisters were selfish or not really dedicated to serving, that they didn't spend more hours with people in need? No. These daily breaks were a direct result of the fact that Mother Teresa saw her whole life as one of service. She knew that she and her sisters would burn out if they didn't have daily opportunities to refill their own cups. You can't put your own life on hold over the long term. Eventually, you'll reach a breaking point where you simply have to take care of yourself. And if you perceive that tending to your own needs can never go hand in hand with serving, you'll stop serving. This realization had been building for a while, and when I read these details about the Missionaries of Charity, it clicked. It really was okay to make time for things that filled me up. Along those lines, Joe and I had started taking turns exercising in the evenings. When he got home from work, I would head out for a walk, which was delightful as much for the chance to listen to my favorite music in peace as for the exercise. When I got back, Joe might run down to the neighborhood pool and swim a few laps. Just a few years before, I would have agonized about this expenditure of time. Now, I saw it as a normal, even necessary part of a love-first life. In early fall, I began to feel that telltale pinching in my right leg. Sure enough, we got a positive pregnancy test the next week. Even though such a moment was nothing new at this point, being my sixth positive test in 8 years, it was still thrilling. I could have 20 children in that first moment of knowing that a new life was now inextricably entwined with mine would never be any less momentous than it was the first time. I was eager to start my blood thinner shots, not because I relished yet another 9 months of stabbing myself in the stomach, but because it was always a relief to get rid of that painful sensation in my calf. But I got a shock when I went to pick up my prescription at the pharmacy. Our insurance coverage had changed, and the price tag was now $2,000 for a one-month supply. After some quick calls to the doctor's office, we found that there was a new, similar line of shots that had just come on the market and would be much cheaper. I switched to that brand and was happy to find that it only had a small copay. I began taking the new brand of shots and anxiously awaited the relief of my leg feeling normal once again. Only this time, it never came. Chapter 29. Hotel Room Shuffle. The pain in my leg continued to bother me, even after a week of the new type of shots. I probably would have thought about it more, but the discomfort wasn't significant, and I had other things distracting me. I was preparing for my first speaking engagement. Thanks to my writing at the Register, a faith-based conference had asked me to give a keynote talk in which I would share my story. Even though the crowd I was addressing wouldn't be larger than 100 people, it was a big milestone. We brought Donald, Lane, and Lucy to the event, and the youngest two stayed with my mom and Yaya. We couldn't afford another hotel room in addition to the one the conference was paying for, so we had to do the shell game of hiding kids from the front desk when we checked in. We affectionately called this the hotel room shuffle. The only problem was that our room was located near the lobby on the ground floor, within sight of the front desk. So we were prisoners once we were inside. The evening after my talk, I wanted Joe to go with me to the conference reception so that I could introduce him to a few people. We took Lane and Lucy with us and walked across the lobby to the event. We left Donald, our hidden child, in the hotel room to watch a movie. We had packed walkie-talkies, and we gave one to him and took the other with us. The girls had already gotten ready for bed, so they were wearing pajamas and socks when we made our grand entrance. People stopped to marvel at this strange family with the sock-footed kids who occasionally murmured to someone on the other end of a walkie-talkie. I had just begun introducing Joe to the conference organizer when an acquaintance from the blog world dashed up. "Jen, hi. I hope I'm not interrupting anything," she said. Her name was Margaret, and she was an established writer in the politics scene. She shared my interest in spirituality and had been following my blog for years, but this event was the first time we'd met in person. She turned to Joe and the organizer to say, "I need to borrow Jen for a second, if that's all right with you, gentlemen." She pulled me away without waiting for them to respond. "I didn't want to say anything before now, because I wasn't sure this would work out," she whispered as we walked quickly to the other side of the room. "But I have someone here for you to meet." We approached a tall cocktail table in the corner where a man in a navy suit and burgundy tie stood clutching a drink in two hands and looking uncomfortable. Before we got close enough that introductions would be warranted, I paused to check in with Donald on the walkie-talkie. "Donald, you good?" A burst of static preceded his response. "Yeah, Mom. 10-4. Over and out." I clipped the walkie-talkie back onto the pocket of my black slacks and approached the table with Margaret. "John, I want you to meet Jennifer," she said graciously. She nodded approvingly as we shook hands, looking regal with her layered auburn hair that was beginning to show a touch of silver, her neat black dress accented with a yellow silk scarf. "John, this is the woman I've been telling you about. I've been reading her blog for years, and I simply adore her writing. Jennifer, John is an acquisitions editor at Salyer Press." "Sell your press?" I blurted out very unsmoothly. In a perfect world, I would have played it off like I was the sort of industry professional who talked to people from Sell Your Press every day, but I was too stunned to think clearly. John is an old buddy of mine from college. He's in town for a publishing conference, so I told him that he had to run over here so I could buy him dinner and so he could meet you, of course. I'll leave you two to chat. And with that, Margaret swept back into the conference crowd at the front of the room. "So, tell me about this book you're writing," John said. He didn't seem overjoyed by this conversation, but I was undaunted. I told him the book was the story of my spiritual journey, leaving out the part about how I had to rewrite the first draft because it was so bad. I mentioned Ted, and he seemed impressed, maybe also surprised, that he was my agent. He asked me to describe my writing style, but before I answered, I had to pause the conversation. "I'm so sorry, I just need to check in with my son quickly," I said, holding up the walkie-talkie. "Donald, you still good in there?" "Can I watch an R-rated movie?" "No, you cannot." "You let me watch that one last week." "No, it was PG-13. And that was, I'm not going into this right now. Listen, Daddy will be back in a second. Don't start any new movies until he gets there." 10-4. I turned back to John. "So sorry about that." He motioned to Joe and my pajama-clad children, who were now waving at us to indicate they were heading back to the room. "I see you have your hands full," he said. "That's not even all my kids. We left two at home. I'm also pregnant." He whistled under his breath. "I don't know how you do all this writing with so many kids, but Margaret says she's a fan, so I'd like to see the manuscript." "You would?" I stammered. I caught myself and forced an air of calmness. "You would. That's wonderful. I do need to make some edits before my agent can send it to you, and with the holidays right around the corner, that will slow me down, but Ted could have it to you early in the new year." A loud electronic screeching blasted from the walkie-talkie on my hip. Then I heard Lane shouting, "I'm Captain Underwear! I'm queen of all the panties!" I felt the moment needed an explanation, so I said, "The kids are back at the room now. This is some game they play where they run around with underwear on their heads." And then I made a mental note never to speak in front of this man again. I fumbled to turn off the squawking device while coolly maintaining eye contact, but instead I accidentally turned the volume as loud as it would go. Now Lucy's voice exploded from the walkie-talkie, an incoherent barrage of noise that was supposed to be happy singing, but sounded like a tortured soul's dispatches from Hades. Then there was a burst of static, and Joe said, "I've got it, Jen. We're back in the room." I finally switched it off and turned back to John. He seemed to be about to ask me a question regarding what he had just witnessed, but shook his head almost imperceptibly. "Here's the problem. Please keep this between us for now, but I've accepted a position somewhere else and will be leaving before spring. I can put in a good word for you with my colleague after I leave, but..." "No, I get it. What's the latest I could have it to you for you to review?" "Mid-February, at the latest." That gave me 4 months. Even factoring in the busyness of the holidays, I could do it. "That will be just fine. In fact, Ted will probably have it to you well before then." I looked him in the eyes and shook his hand confidently, like my parents always taught me to do. After we said goodbyes and I took his card, I made sure to do my finest, best-selling author walk in case he was watching me. I barely held it together to say a few goodbyes to Margaret and other folks I knew in the crowd, and as soon as I was out of sight, I broke into a run. I wore a huge, goofy grin as I anticipated sharing this news with Joe and the kids. I was so swept up in the moment, I barely even noticed that my right calf ached with every step. By the time the holidays arrived, I had made little progress on the revisions, and Ted couldn't pitch the manuscript to Salyer or to anyone else until they were done. At first I thought it was simply resistance, but soon it became clear that something was wrong. My energy was sapped beyond what I had ever experienced in pregnancy, which was especially strange since I was in good shape before this baby came along. I was still early in the second trimester, but every time I walked up the stairs of our house, I had to pause and and lean against the wall to catch my breath. I stopped taking my regular walks in the evening, since I often ran out of steam only a half block away from the house. The pain in my leg never did resolve. I still had that annoying pinch every time I walked. I railed against my physical limitations, whose exasperating timing seemed to come right when I was poised to bring all of my writing dreams to fruition. The speaking engagement had paid a generous stipend. I now had a contact at Salyer. The book was almost finished. I was still in talks with the magazine to take a prestigious columnist position with them. Over and over again, I tried to power through my exhaustion to get words on the page and hit deadlines. And over again, I failed. My physical weakness made me feel unable to deal with even the smallest challenges. Joe offered to cook dinner and to do the entire cleanup, bath, and bedtime routine on his own. The only thing I would have to do would be to give the kids their goodnight kisses, but even that felt like an arduous, complicated task. All of this combined to leave me feeling disconnected from the entire world, like I was a lazy ghost who huffed and puffed around the house. It used to be impossible for me to relax enough to nap during the day. Now I used all my babysitter time to sleep. The big fear with my clotting disorder was pulmonary embolism, a blood clot that starts somewhere else, often in a leg, and ends up in your lungs. This condition was no joke. It could be fatal with little to no warning. But even though I was short of breath, I was pretty sure that wasn't what was going on. I didn't have any other symptoms like shooting pains or coughing up blood. And besides, I was taking blood thinner shots every day, just like I always had during pregnancy. I'd seen a general practice doctor for a routine checkup, and he'd assured me that it was pregnancy fatigue. I nodded and quietly agreed that that must be it. But with every day that went by, it got harder to ignore the fact that something was very wrong. Chapter 30. Breathless. "You seem out of breath," my obstetrician said before we'd even finished our hellos. This was his first appointment after the New Year break, and I was desperately happy to be here. My energy level and shortness of breath were now at the point that I had barely been able to drive myself here. If this kept going, I'd be an invalid within a couple of weeks. My plan was not to leave this office until he gave me something that would make me feel better. "Yeah, I don't feel so great." "Try to speak for as long as you can without taking a breath. Tell me about Christmas." "It was..." I couldn't get out the third word, Kafka-esque, without gasping for air. "You need to go to the ER." "What?" "Right now. There's one at the front of the building. Do you need a nurse to take you?" I shook my head about the nurse, but I didn't see why I needed to go at all. You can't get pulmonary embolisms when you're on blood thinners, right? "I've been taking my shots." "You need to go now." The doctor's office was part of a hospital complex that had an emergency room. Normally, I would have made the walk in about 3 minutes. This time, it took me 10. I had to pause every few steps, lean against a wall, and gasp for breath. My condition was worse even than it had been the week before. When I arrived at the ER, there were two nurses standing in the waiting room to greet me. They had an admissions bracelet ready and slapped it on my arm before I'd even left the entryway. They led me into a triage room where an IV was started the moment I sat on the hospital bed. The nurses and a doctor exchanged staccato phrases to catch one another up on what my obstetrician had told them. "What is this blood condition you have?" the doctor asked. "Factor 2," I said. He didn't seem to recognize the name, which wasn't surprising. Nobody ever did. "It's like factor 5, with a twist. And I'm homozygous."
"You mean heterozygous?"
"No, I have both copies of the gene."
"What are the odds of that?" he said under his breath.
"Honey, how many weeks pregnant are you?" a nurse asked.
22.
There was hushed chatter, and then the doctor turned back to me.
We have to do a CT scan. Joe texted to ask if he should come down, but I told him to wait until we had more answers after the scan. His office was 40 minutes away from the hospital, and I didn't want him driving all the way over just to hear another doctor tell me it was pregnancy fatigue. After the CT scan, I was wheeled back to a station in the main part of the ER, where my bed was separated from those next to me by plastic divider curtains. I'd begun playing around on my phone to pass the time for what I was sure would be a long wait, when a nurse swung the curtain aside and rushed to grab my arm with the IV. She pulled off the cap on the tube and injected a clear liquid into it. "What's that?" I asked. She hesitated. "The doctor will be here in a second." No sooner had she said that than the same doctor from before came back in. He had a friendly face with a dark beard and warm brown eyes, but right now he looked stricken. "It's pulmonary embolism." "What? But I was on blood thinners." That useless statement was becoming my mantra, as if this whole situation would fade away if I kept repeating it enough, like Dorothy chanting, "There's no place like home," in The Wizard of Oz. "The radiologist isn't done looking at the results, but you have clots in both lungs. Some of them are so big a layman could recognize them on the scan images." "I don't know." He seemed to decide not to say whatever he'd been about to say. "We're admitting you to the hospital. You should call your family." By the time Joe arrived at my room, I had so many wires and monitors attached to me that he couldn't give me a hug. We shook hands with mock formality, and he sat down in the chair next to my bed. I told him that the doctor said my condition was now stable, and we moved on to discussing the plan for childcare while I was in here. There were no grand emotional statements, no final "I love yous" in case whatever they put in my IV was as effective as those shots I'd been doing. It wasn't our style. Joe and I were both at our calmest and most reasonable when we were under stress. Back when we were dating, we'd had more than a few screaming arguments, which was probably due in part to the fact that alcohol was one of the food groups in our diet. But I often thought it was also because we didn't have big life pressures to keep us from disagreeing over minutiae. We almost never got in arguments anymore, for the same reason that people stuck in lifeboats surrounded by sharks don't spend much time arguing with one another. After he left, I was in the room alone except for the nurse who came by to check my vitals every half hour. This could have been an opportunity for me to reflect on the fact that I had narrowly escaped death. I probably should have used that evening in the quiet hospital room to praise God and think deep thoughts about life and the meaning of mortality. Instead, I started freaking out about how my house would ever run without me. Joe would have to take time off of work. Even then, how could he possibly handle serving breakfast and lunch and dinner in addition to everything else that had to be done? Who would take the kids to their activities? Our mothers would surely provide assistance as they could, but my mom worked full-time, and Yaya could only do so much. I didn't even want to think about how we'd pay the pile of medical bills that were undoubtedly hurtling toward our mailbox. I had a spacious private room to myself at the corner of the hall. It had elegant cherry wood paneling and two polished windows. At a glance, it looked more like a hotel than a hospital. The window to my right looked out onto the helipad, and in the middle of my worries, the blades of the Life Flight helicopter started to spin. They twirled until they became invisible, and then the body of the craft floated upward as gently as a bubble in water. For a short moment, I stopped fretting about the details of my life. My attention was transfixed by the graceful movements of the helicopter, and I felt only concern for whoever was on the other end of that flight. As I watched the aircraft shrink into a distant light in the night sky, I stopped all my frantic thoughts to thank God that I was alive to witness this moment, and to pray for all the people who were out there in my city, struggling for their lives tonight. Chapter 31. Running Underwater. I needed to stay in the hospital for observation, even though I was out of immediate danger.
I was not able to breathe any better than when I was diagnosed, so even simple movements like walking to the bathroom required long recovery time. I spent most of my days using the free Wi-Fi to Google my condition, which made me wonder why hospitals hadn't blocked medical sites yet. By the third day, I had convinced myself that I had three different untreatable syndromes, a brain parasite usually only found in East Cambodia, as well as permanent scarring to my lungs that would leave me gasping for the rest of my life. I harangued doctors and nurses with information I'd learned from medical experts like Bad Boy Billy 94 on various internet forums. The one highlight of my research was when I found a video where a doctor explained how pulmonary embolisms become fatal, and I noticed halfway in that the soundtrack in the background was Snoop Dogg's Drop It Like It's Hot. It seemed like the world should hit the pause button until I could get back to running it, but oddly, it didn't. Hardly an hour passed without me remembering something that urgently needed to be done. The kids need to finish their current math workbooks to stay on track with homeschool. Lucy needs to bring a photo of herself for a project at religious ed class. There's a mandatory parent meeting for the church summer camp this week. Donald needs to have that song memorized for drum lessons. I sent Joe a text every time I thought of yet another thing he would need to take care of in my absence. Every time I sent a new message, I expected to get a reply that said, "New phone, who dis?" One morning, in the middle of another trip down an internet rabbit trail that made me suspect that I had both rabies and malaria, an email popped into my inbox. Most of the notes I received these days were well wishes from friends and family members, but this one was something different. It was a note from the editor-in-chief of the magazine I'd been talking to, saying they'd found a position for me. The job he was offering was actually better than the one we'd recently discussed, but he needed a sample column to take to his board to get final approval. It was jarring to think about work again. The email brought back that whole situation, the book, the Salyer opportunity, my hopes for my burgeoning career, as if I were an amnesiac who suddenly recalled her old life. A tidal wave of excitement and stress surged through me as I remembered everything that was going on in that arena. This offer at the magazine would mean that, if it came through, I'd need to leave my blogging job at the Register. Honestly, this magazine opportunity felt like a drag in comparison, but it would be more of a true job, and the impressive title that would come with it would certainly open other doors for me as well. Meanwhile, there was the opportunity at Salyer Press. The acquisitions editor, John, would be leaving in about a month. I hadn't finished the manuscript revisions. I felt like the correct response to all of this would be to say that none of it mattered in the big picture. I don't worry about silly things like book contracts and job offers at magazines anymore, I imagined a more spiritually mature person saying. But I had wanted all of this for so long, and I had worked so hard to get it, and it was so, so close to being within my grasp that even my current circumstances couldn't smother my excitement. I sat up in my hospital bed and brushed my hair out of my face. I had to make this work. If I missed out on either of these opportunities, they'd go away forever. My fingers zipped across the keyboard as I made lists and plans and goals. But it wasn't long before I became exhausted, and I had to push the laptop aside to rest. I was trying to make my dreams a reality, but I felt like I was running underwater. A nasty chest flu filled the rooms of the hospital with coughing, wheezing patients. The doctors made the decision to send me home, since I would have big problems if I caught this virus with my lungs in their current condition. Joe arrived to help me pack, and when he walked in, he handed me a greeting card. As I slipped it out of its envelope, I assumed I'd encounter a get well message. Instead, it was a sympathy card, the kind you might give someone whose pet died. "With my deepest sympathy," it said on the front, the words in an elegant script over a photo of a field of lavender. I opened it to see that Joe had interspersed his own handwritten thoughts with the comforting verses that were pre-printed in the card. It read like this: "It's hard whenever something is lost, like blood thinners that actually work, and you find yourself down in the dumps,
At least you're still hot, though.
Due to the grief you feel.
Because your life totally sucks right now.
But you must take hope in the graces of the future.
And blood thinners that actually work.
Let me know how I can minister to you during this time.
Like punch someone in the face who's getting on your nerves.
Then, at the bottom, he added,
I love you, baby. We'll get through this.
As usual, Joe knew exactly what I needed. I leaned forward to hug him, but got caught in my wires like a bug in a spider web. He stepped away from his work packing my suitcase and walked over to give me a kiss on my forehead.
I got that card at the pharmacy when I was picking up your new medicine. I made sure they switched us back to the old type that we always used to use.
I never thought I'd be excited about giving myself a shot, I said, still not able to talk without gasping.
I was especially surprised by my excitement considering that they'd doubled my dose, so now I had to give myself shots in the stomach twice a day.
Joe went back over to the table where my toiletries had collected and resumed putting them in my suitcase.
I think we're famous at the pharmacy now. The whole staff gathered around to see who was going to pay this bill.
Yeah, I bet they don't see a lot of $2,000 tabs.
I couldn't even think about the fact that that was only for a one-month supply, and we'd need to come up with the money again in a few weeks.
Joe made a noise.
Was that a laugh? A snicker?
What?
It was $2,000. Keep in mind, they doubled your dose.
So wait. That means...
Joe tossed the white pharmacy bag onto the bed. Take a look. It's really something else.
I grabbed the bag, which bulged with the bulky boxes of pre-filled shots.
I turned it around to see the folded, stapled stack of papers that included the injection instructions and the receipt. And there was the total. $4,090.29 for a one-month supply.
Did this come with a car? I asked between breaths.
I think they forgot to mention that a butler administers these shots in a private jet.
Let's not think about the other things we could do with this money.
Let's not think about the fact that we don't have the money. Put it on the credit card. That'll be a bracing moment when we open that bill.
Our families could help us cover this round, but then there would be another one next month and the month after that.
Also, the bills from my ER trip and hospital stay would be coming in soon.
A nurse came in to extricate me from my tangle of wires so I could go home.
Joe and I sat in the silence as she worked, both of us lost in our thoughts.
At the end of the week, I was at my hematologist's office for what I thought was a routine follow-up when he announced that he had an idea. From the way he delivered this news, I was pretty sure it wasn't a new patient rewards program.
You need an IBC filter.
A what?
It's a filter that goes in your vena cava to block clots from reaching your lungs.
Oh, okay. I guess that sounds good. I said, my speech still slow as I struggled for breath.
Then something occurred to me.
But how do they get the filter in the vein?
He rubbed his hands together as if trying to conjure the right words.
Well, that's the thing.
Not the start to the answer I was looking for. He went on to describe a procedure that would involve a tube being wound through a smaller vein, then over and into the vena cava. Normally, we'd go through your thigh, but since you're pregnant, it would be best to come at it from the neck. Through gasping breaths, I repeated his words back to him, making sure I understood correctly that he was suggesting that I would be stabbed in the neck by a tube that would go snaking around deep into my body until it got near my lungs and heart.
That's right, he said. And since you're pregnant, we can't use most of the sedatives we normally use. You'll be awake for the procedure.
I tried to find a polite way to say, there is not even a chance this will happen.
I doubt we can get it low enough to protect all of your organs, but we can at least cover your heart and lungs. That way, if you throw a clot, you'll only experience kidney failure.
We'll also have to make sure we position it so that the baby doesn't put pressure on it,
since that could perforate the vein. Excellent. I see that you're resistant to this, he said perceptively. You don't need to do it this week, but it'll have to be sometime before labor. I'll have the nurse schedule it about a month before the induction. I stumbled out of the appointment in a daze. I'd driven myself to this appointment since all of the other adults in our family were busy with various child care duties, holding down the fort since I was still mostly incapacitated. I flopped into the car and took a moment to catch my breath. To distract myself from the details of the procedure itself, I thought of anything else. What to ask my mom to pick up during her next trip to the store. What Yaya meant when she said in an email that, "Pammy washed the dog with my coffee this morning." And then I thought about my work. The doctor had said this neck stabbing procedure would take place a month before labor. Between the recovery time and preparations for the new baby, I would get nothing done in terms of bookwork between then and the delivery. And then, after the baby was here, I would be out of commission for a while. So, in other words, anything that didn't get done before the procedure wasn't going to get done. That was 6 weeks from now. My deadline for John was 4 weeks from now, and I had to write the sample column for the magazine, too. I was running out of time. Chapter 32. Lifted Up. The medical bills were now coming in day after day, as if we had signed up for an invoice subscription service. I tried to call the insurance company to question some of the more outrageous numbers, but my first attempt ended in failure. The account was in Joe's name, and they would only talk to him, but he was busier than ever. I came up with a plan to deal with these claims without using his time. I'd pretend to be him. I'd always had a deep voice for a woman. When I watched the video of Donald's last birthday party, I heard a voice in the background that made me wonder what James Earl Jones was doing at our celebration and why he was being so bossy. It was disorienting to realize that that was my voice. So I figured this could work, especially now that I could breathe more easily. This call would be fine. I closed the door so I could focus on my technique. Sitting on the edge of the bed, I held the insurance form in front of me and dialed the number. After navigating the touch-tone system, I finally reached a customer service representative. I cleared my throat and put on my deepest, most masculine voice and boomed into the telephone.
"Yes, I would like to speak to someone about this medical claim you denied."
I sounded 10 times more ridiculous than I thought I would. I didn't exactly sound like a woman, but I didn't sound like a man either. I was like a genderless robot programmed by an incompetent alien race to mimic human speech. "Certainly," the woman on the other end of the line said. "With whom am I speaking?" I put on the weird robot voice again.
"Okay, yes, this is..."
I couldn't do it. This was too absurd. Why did I have to shout when I used this voice? I dropped the whole charade and said in my normal tone and volume, "Jennifer. This is Jennifer Fulweiler." The customer service agent hesitated just long enough to confirm that she definitely thought that she was on the phone with the most insane person in the world. She told me politely that she could only talk to Joe, and we both ended the call quickly. I moved slowly over to Joe's side of the bed, where I put this latest claim form on top of a large stack of other bills and papers for him to deal with. We were out of money. My health was still fragile. I could hardly do anything to keep the household running. There didn't seem to be any way to pull together the book or the column in time, and we were about to have another baby in the house. It felt like the wheels of the clown car of our life were coming off. I had just said goodbye to Monica when there was a knock at the door. As usual, the kids reacted to the sound like mad Pavlovian dogs, arguing and pushing to see who our new visitor was. We hadn't been getting out of the house much lately. I told everyone to calm down, since it was just the babysitter coming back because she forgot something. But when Lane opened the door, it wasn't Monica on the porch. It was Christy, the supermom who ran the meal ministry for the priests. She held a large foil-covered baking dish in one hand and carried a bulging canvas grocery bag in another. And I noticed she was wearing white again. Now a second person, whom I recognized as another volunteer cook, trotted up behind her, holding her own canvas bag and announcing that she got the bread. What bread? What was going on here? Before I could ask, Christy explained, "Hi, Jennifer. Father Dean emailed us to say that you've been ill. He mentioned that he brought you communion in the hospital. Isn't he wonderful?" She stepped inside, once again moving as if she were in this space every day. To say that my house looked like it had been robbed would be an insult to robbers. It looked like thieves had broken into the place, intended to rob it, and just got drunk and thrashed around for a while instead. She didn't seem to mind. "Anyway, the other meal ministry folks and I set up a care calendar for you, so you'll have meals every night for the next 6 weeks." "Oh my gosh, seriously?" "Put this one in the freezer," she said to the lady who was helping her, whose name I couldn't remember. "Word got around and a bunch of other families from church signed up, so it should be quite some time before you need to cook again." She adeptly set out a stack of plastic and foil containers with the food for tonight, a roast with sides of homemade garlic mashed potatoes and buttered green beans. There was another full meal for tomorrow, which she stored in the fridge. She wiped her hands on a dish rag she found in a drawer, locating it on her first try, then used it to dab a spot of condensation that the containers had left on the counter. The kitchen was now more orderly than it was when she'd arrived. She and her helper friend left after about 1,000 thank yous from me, and I pulled up this care calendar thing on my phone. Each week was filled with the last names of people from our parish, each of them choosing a date to deliver a meal. The first two names were women who were in my Bible charades group at the extrovert retreat. The next day, the neighbor girls came over, knocking as everyone did since the doorbell was still out of service from when I disconnected it that afternoon years before. They carried two disposable casserole pans overflowing with their mother's favorite recipes. These dishes could easily be our lunches for the next few days. "Is Mr. Joe home yet?" Carmen asked as I was putting away the food. "Not yet. Unfortunately, he has to work late tonight." She looked at Megan and Riley for confirmation, then offered, "Why don't we stay and watch the kids so you can chill out for a while? You can go upstairs and read a book or whatever. You don't need to pay us anything." I told them they were absolutely angels sent directly from heaven and took them up on their offer. 2 days later, they came by to offer their free babysitting services again, then the next week as well. I started making them nervous with the intensity with which I conveyed my gratitude. I'd look them in the eyes for an awkwardly long time, burning with sincerity as I said, "No, seriously, you do not understand what this means to me." They kept saying they were just happy to help. On one such day, right before I was about to fall into bed for a nap, I noticed a stack of letters on the side of the dresser. Joe must have put it there after he checked the mail, but I'd only now noticed it. All of it was addressed to me. I tore open 5 envelopes, each of them cards with well wishes. 2 were from my aunts. Another was from an uncle. Some of them contained checks or cash. I was reading a kind note when the phone rang. It was Hallie. "Hey, I am getting overwhelmed with requests from your blog readers," she said. Hallie had recently set up her own website where she shared stories and inspiration. Like me, she had found that this creative outlet gave her a whole new source of energy. "I guess people are finding my contact info from my site since they know we're friends, but everyone is asking me to set up a fundraiser to help you." "Wow." "Yeah, I want to do it. Word has gotten around about the cost of this medicine, and people are adamant about helping. Is that okay?" "That's so nice, but don't say you couldn't accept. Honestly, you should read some of these emails. People really want to help, Jen." Hallie put the fundraiser button up that afternoon, and the donations poured in immediately. I didn't want to watch the numbers too closely so that I could maintain a mindset of being happy with whatever we were given. I didn't look at the site again until almost a week later. When I did, I shouted so loudly that Joe called upstairs to see if I was okay. People had given us almost $10,000. What was even more meaningful than the dollar amount was the notes. The form allowed donors to include a comment with their gifts, and I was moved to tears as I read through them. Some shared about difficult times in their own families. Some told stories of how something I wrote helped them, or more often, just made them laugh at the ridiculousness of a crazy situation I'd gotten myself into. Everyone said they were thinking of us and praying for us. I felt uplifted by the love of this community, as if they were physically holding me up. I once thought of my writing work, perhaps especially the time I spent updating my blog, as a self-indulgent activity. Yet what I saw from this flood of gifts and comments was that what I had done had helped people, not because I had mind-blowing talent or because I had skills that others don't possess, but simply because I had put something out there. I had taken powerful moments in my life, both the poignant and the absurd, and had made my best effort to distill them into words. And like a photographer who shares an image of something that moved her, or a poet who writes a few lines about what's on his heart, it gave people a new way to look at one small slice of the human experience. In the end, that's what all art does. Even the informal mediums like blogging make us more human and more connected in our shared humanness. I asked Hallie to take down the donation link, since this would be enough to cover my shots for the rest of the pregnancy almost completely, and that was more than I could have ever dreamed I would get. After the final donation came in, I pulled up the list and read each note again, wiping tears from my cheeks as I beheld this unfathomable outpouring of love. Chapter 33. That could have been me. Joe and I sat in the waiting room of my hematologist, who was running an hour late. At any other office, that news would have annoyed me, but this place was different. My hematologist primarily worked with people who had cancer, so this waiting room had a way of putting everything in perspective. Joe and I settled in close to one another on a floral-printed couch in the corner. The only other people in the room were a couple in their 50s. The woman wore a colorful scarf over her balding scalp, and she interacted with her husband with cheerfulness. Joe and I kept our voices low so we wouldn't disturb them as we spoke about all the issues we faced. The generosity we'd received had been nothing short of life-changing, but, as we now discussed, even that outpouring of support didn't come close to resolving everything. "We're in over our heads," I said, as much to myself as to Joe. I expected him to lean forward and pull out a folded 3-page spreadsheet from his back pocket and start pointing to numbers to illustrate the elaborate plan he'd concocted to get us out of this mess. Instead, he said quietly, "I know." We held hands, both of us silent. I watched the woman in the scarf say something to her husband. When she looked at him, her glance wasn't casual. She beamed when their eyes met. When she smiled, it wasn't a perfunctory gesture. It was a big, wide, all-in expression. She playfully punched him in the arm and leaned in affectionately as she told him a story. He made a brief comment, and she laughed, a hearty laugh that was so bold that both receptionists looked up when it filled the room. A flicker of desire registered within me, a desire to possess the same kind of carefree joy this woman had. But it was quickly smothered by my worries. I had so much work to do before the vein filter procedure. I was almost finished with the revisions on the book. There was only one thing left to do, but it was a big thing. I had to rewrite a chapter. When that was done, I would need to put together a proposal for Ted to send to Salyer, and that would be a long process in and of itself. On top of that, I needed to write a sample column for the magazine job, and they needed it soon. I summarized all of this for Joe. He seemed to be half listening, more engaged in watching the interactions between the woman in the colorful scarf and her husband. I had only paused, not even finished with my manic ramblings, when Joe spoke slowly and calmly. "What if you let it go?" My voice was muted but shrill. Let what go? This cellular opportunity. The magazine column. How much less stress would you be under if you loosened your grip on these things and just let them pass? Joe, come on. These are the kinds of opportunities